Tell that to the blisters on my feet. We're not out of options. Sombra might be right about Casey. I'll do some reading and check in with the priest at the stole. In the meantime, we keep stealing Julin's letters and make copies for ourselves. Sombra smiled thinly. I see.
See what? Lou said. That we're getting dragged into a fight we've got no business with?
This man is an agent of the minister. The minister seeks Selin. Their correspondence might contain intelligence regarding it.
Which we can take a peek at while staying 200 miles outside Spiron, Dante said.
Even if there's no mention of Selin, the letters might help us figure out where in Kaul that information might be kept.
Sounds like you'll have plenty to do, C said. What about the rest of us?
It's a big city. Figure out how to make yourselves useful. They headed downstairs. Casey called to them from the back room. Dante rejoined her, standing just inside the doorway.
Satisfied, she said.
The portion was leaner than I'd hoped.
She chuckled. If I knew how to get the damn thing, you think I'd drop it in your lap rather than grab it for myself?
Then why tell me anything at all? I don't have time to go dashing off after legends and myths, not if I hope to find proof of the minister's invasion before his troops hold their own sit in Ellen's streets.
Dante drifted forward.
The letter wasn't proof enough.
It's a start.
But stealing one letter is like hearing one sentence in the middle of a conversation. You've got no context for the whole.
She had a plate of fried, finger-sized objects. She picked one up and crunched it.
I got a proposal. You're a heck of a thief. I know people all over this city. You bring me more letters, and I get my people to go digging for more tidbits about your star.
Dante fought not to smile at Sombra.
I think we can continue on those terms.
He headed out into the caverns. Some people haggled in the streets while others retired to empty buildings to hammer out their agreements. Men trundled along pulling long-handled carts laden with goods concealed by tarps. On one occasion, the goods under the tarp squirmed. They headed up to what he'd heard people in the Echoes refer to as New Ellen, and went back to the inn. There they talked about moving down into the Echoes, but Dante didn't want to get too close to Casey. While he waited for darkness to fall, he read The Cycle of Geryn, meaning to finally absorb enough to hold a meaningful conversation with Mickle. Maybe the priest would have no more to tell him than Horace, but the stoles of Ellen were equal parts university and monastery. There might not be a better source of knowledge in Wesley.
The horns blared. Official-looking men and women in plain white robes snapped out blankets and set down trays of simple food. Rice wrapped in leaves, strips of spiced and dried laurels. Citizens gathered in the streets, augmenting the fare with platters of their own.
Night came. When the hour grew late, Dante led the others to the pub across the street from Julin's apartment. Fresh letters lay on the desk. Repeating the night before, the rat snatched them up and carried them down to Sombra, who delivered them to Dante and Lou at the pub. They transcribed feverishly, with Dante copying one page, then passing it to Lou to make another, while Dante dived into the second page. Working in tandem, it took no longer to make two copies than it had to make one. Julin was still asleep when the rat returned his missives to his desk. To defray any suspicion from Casey, they delivered her copy first, then headed back to the inn to take a good look at theirs.
"Ast," Dante said, lowering the pages, "will you tell me if this makes any more sense to you than it does to me?"
Ast moved to the desk and spread his fingers wide, separating the copied pages. His eyes tracked across one line after the next. He didn't give his assessment until the very end.
"It reads like our subject is a lunatic."
"Ryan? How is this?"
intelligence. Do we even know for sure that Julin is working for the minister?
Please, Somber said, voice dripping with disgust.
He tapped the pages together and skimmed through them, shoulders hunched.
It's written in code.
What's it say?
I don't know. It's code.
Treating its encryption as an established fact, Dante said, do you think you can decipher it?
There are few I can't, but it could take a long time. It would help to have more texts to compare.
Somber went to work immediately.
Dante sat down with a sigh. The next 3 days and nights unfolded identically. He read the cycle of Jaren, stole and copied letters, delivered them to Casey, while Somber and Lou chipped away at the code, filling the desk with scribbles and wadded paper.
C began disappearing into the city. Sometimes she took Ast with her. If she found anything, she didn't deem it worthy of mention.
Dante finished Jaren, went to the Stole of the Winds, and waited 3 hours for an audience with Mickle. Their conversation was dizzying, from a theological perspective, but the only reference Mickle made to Selen was to the same story Horace had summarized. Mickle offered a few interpretations, explaining that Jaren's tale served as a precursor to the conflict between the tribes of the Rashan and the Elson. Aron was always distant and intractable, with his daughter Jaren serving as a bridge between his godly aloofness and the concerns of flesh and blood people. Intriguing, but outside the scope of Dante's practical interests. Dante walked away from the Stole amidst an acute crisis of confidence. The fact that the truth felt closer than ever made him aware of just how little he knew. His progress was proving so slow. Meanwhile, being so far removed from his homeland in Narashtovik made him feel as though he were falling behind, missing out. On what, he couldn't quite say. Yet he had the same feelings toward Ellen. Here, he was in the middle of a fantastically exotic city, a place with an actual underground and a thriving, sociable culture of trade. And he was busy spending his days reading ancient tomes and his nights reading gibberish.
He gazed up at a brick tower with a round top and, on a whim, ran to its front doors. They were locked.
He continued back to the inn. It was deeply tempting to relax his pursuit of Selen and spend more time enjoying this place he might never return to, its spiced foods, its architecture, which felt skeletal in design yet stood strong as a fortress, its friendly people. If he were a different person, he might have succumbed. Yet if he found Selen, he'd have centuries to experience the world. His quest for that life wasn't something that had sprouted after he'd learned about Selen and the opportunities it might grant him. He had always wanted to live longer, to be bigger. That's what had driven him to the Nether in the first place. To Kali, whose knowledge and power were even more staggering than the span of his life. And after that, to accept the mantle of the head of the council. All along, he'd been honing his skills with the intention of living as damn long as he possibly could. Not just for himself. Consider Jaren, wise, resourceful, heroic, savior of a people. Perhaps she was a myth, or exaggeration, but it didn't matter. If you could become a Jaren, or a Kali, or a Hop, or a Lerimor, you owed it to your people to endure. That was what compelled him to endure, even when the path was lost and the answers seemed further away than ever. Back at the inn, Somber and Lou were bent over the table, arguing the meaning of a line of text involving handkerchiefs and fish heads. As soon as they took a break to glare at each other, Dante spoke up.
Have you made any progress decrypting the letters?
Of course, Somber said, stung. I've successfully ruled several things out.
Dante took a moment to absorb this.
Tell me if I'm shelling the wrong nut here, but would it help if you had some words to search for? Ones that might repeat within the text?
It depends on the manner of the encryption, Somba said. But it could help, yes.
I'll see what I can do.
That night, after they'd stolen, copied, and delivered the day's letters to Casey's, Dante lingered inside her room, waiting for her to look up from the pages.
I haven't got anything more about your star yet, she said at last.
I figured, but I'm curious. How do you know the minister intends to invade Ellen?
Well, my first clue would be the army.
I didn't see an army while I was there, Dante said.
Sure. That's 'cause he's drilling it in the lowlands, which is my second clue. If he aimed to take a swipe at the northern barbarians, you think he'd train in the plains?
There's plains for 200 miles in all directions. Dante gestured sweepingly, and uselessly, given that they were 40 feet beneath those plains.
What makes you think he'll come here?
Because he's from here. She leaned forward, forearms on her knees.
Son of the Lady Janessa. Old, old Ellenite family. The minister used that status to marry his way into the Spirish nobility. From there, he more or less bowled and bludgeoned his way to the top.
That seems tenuous. If he has family ties to Ellen, wouldn't he be less likely to burn it to the ground?
You'd think, wouldn't you? Except these letters are plump full of talk about revenge on the homeland.
That one might cause the town elders to sit up and take notice. He waved at her and left. Back at the inn, Lou was resting his chin on his crossed forearms, gazing blankly at his scribblings.
Somber had his head tipped back and his mouth wide open, as if he was willing the ceiling to sprout a tap.
"Revenge on the homeland," Dante said. "Supposedly that phrase is all up and down the letters."
Somber clacked his teeth shut and tipped his head to the side to get a look at him.
"Is that so? Amazing what you can turn up when you go outside and talk to people."
Without another word, Somber seated himself at the table and got back to work. C and Ast were out and about in the city, but Dante was too tired to wait up for them.
In the morning, he walked around until he found a vendor selling flaky honey pastries and a reddish tea sweetened with cream, cinnamon, and spices Dante had never tasted. He spread a blanket in a patch of sunlight in the square.
Over at the pastry stall, a woman argued vociferously with the vendor. Dante smiled at himself. He'd forgotten to haggle.
When he finished eating, he returned to their rooms, picked up the cycle of Geron, then set it back down. He'd already completed it.
While he had segments he wanted to revisit, that could wait.
Instead, he grabbed writing supplies and went back out to the square. The morning was bracing. He went to the vendor for a second cup of tea, managing to talk the man down to a ring coin just 2/3 as thick as the asking price. He took the drink back to his spot in the sun. All of this wasn't so bad. As isolated moments, they were quite enjoyable. But his moments weren't like the obelisk standing in the middle of the fountain across the plaza. They were more like the letters of a sentence. They only had meaning in conjunction with the others, and the more meaningless letters you injected into the text, the less sense it made. Still seated in the sun, his one concession toward trying to enjoy his environment, he got back to work. For the rest of the morning, he wrote up everything he'd read and heard regarding Selen, collating scattered notes into a single file. First-hand knowledge, such as the accounts in Geron, say, was depressingly scant, but writing it out allowed him to assess the gestalt and get his thoughts down in writing, clarifying them. It felt like he might have a few beams and joists in place. Useless on their own,
nothing you could shelter under, but if he found the proper materials, he'd have a frame to hang them on.
That night, during his delivery to the Echoes, Casey beckoned him out of the main hall, down a corridor, to a room that appeared to be in the midst of a battle between cushions and swords. Despite all the weapons, Dante took it to be her bedroom.
"Don't get any ideas," she smirked. "You up for a change of work?"
"Dying for it.
Put the letter theft on hold for now. Starting tomorrow morning, keep Julian's place under watch. No breaks. Send someone running if he moves."
"I thought he never leaves his room," Dante said.
"He doesn't, but according to his last letter, he's about to break that habit."
"What is it? A meet?"
"More than that."
Her tone was amused, yet wary. "You might call it an orientation."
"The minister's bringing more people into the city."
"So he thinks."
She tapped her nails on her hip. "Anyway, I'm much appreciated."
Dante headed back to the inn to apprise the others of their latest task.
"So what?" C said. "We sit around a pub and watch his building? You mean the same thing we've been doing?"
"Pretty much."
Lou pinched the middle of his upper lip.
"Why not surround the building with your watchful rodents? While you sit right next to Casey. You could alert her the instant Julian moves."
"I'd prefer to keep her in the dark concerning what I'm capable of," Dante said. "I don't want to get sucked in too deep. As soon as Samba figures out whether there's anything useful in the letters, we're on the move."
"A compromise," Samba said. "You watch from up here. I position myself in the Echoes. When he moves, you loon me. I alert Casey Gage."
"Solid plan. Just don't get involved, all right?"
"I have no intention of placing myself between a pair of clashing swords."
Plan set, Dante went out to kill a half dozen more rats. It didn't take long. To slow their decay, he raised them on the spot and shuffled them off to a corner of the closet where they wouldn't disturb Lou. Though he didn't expect Julian to move until night, that was when such things always took place, on the day of the meet, Dante got up bright and early, pocketed his rats, and took them to the alley behind the inn. In ones and twos, he sent them running towards Julian's building, sticking to back streets, hunkering down in the garbage whenever someone went by. Completely paranoid, given that there were rats in every alley, but there was no sense in attracting attention. Dante installed himself in the public house. Samba descended to the Echoes. Lou joined Dante in the pub while C and Ast strolled around the neighboring blocks, haggling with street vendors and wandering in and out of clothiers. By early afternoon, with their feet tiring and no signs of anything out of the ordinary, they came to the pub as well. All the while, Dante watched through the eyes of the rats. This kept him busy. The building had two main exits as well as two side doors, and Dante had to let his attention drift above any one set of eyes, homing in on a specific rat only when it detected motion. This happened scores of times throughout the day, and was thoroughly exhausting to follow. By nightfall, there had been no sign of Julian. Dante had had a few beers over the course of the day, and he began to nod off. He got up to take a walk around the chilly night and clear his head. He had barely stepped into the square when the building's side door opened and Julian emerged. Dante veered the opposite direction, turned a corner, and sat down to pretend to fiddle with the laces of his boots. He opened his loon.
"Knack? Tell Somber he's on the move, heading north on Cleftridge Lane."
Knack had been asleep, and Dante had to repeat his instructions twice before Knack was cogent enough to relay them. A moment later, he let Dante know that Samba was on his way to see Casey. Julian's footsteps had already faded down the street. Dante sent two rats to follow at a distance, then huffed it back to the pub and told the others the bear had finally emerged from hibernation. Using Knack as a middleman,
Somba told Dante that Casey's people were running flat out through the echoes to catch up to Julin, who was roughly a third of a mile north of them, above ground.
Somba planned to stay put and keep an eye on Casey's.
In the pub, Dante passed this to the others.
Sounds like there's about to be a brawl.
C tipped her mug to examine its contents.
Should we wander over that way?
There were plenty of reasons to stay at a distance, but Dante wanted a better idea of who they were dealing with in Casey Gage. Anyway, in the last week, he'd done little but sit around this pub and the inn. They headed out as a group, walking north.
Julin dropped off Cleftridge and cut through a dizzying maze of side streets. The rats followed, advancing in a leapfrog pattern, one following half a block behind Julin, while the other lingered behind.
Dante gained ground on him, but lagged blocks behind.
10 minutes after Casey had left her building, the rearguard rat spied a group of 8 people moving swiftly down the alleys. They wore dark clothes, scarves wrapped tight around their brows and mouths. The whites of their eyes shined in the weak light. All 8 were armed. Disguised, though they were, Dante identified Casey and Horace. A couple blocks ahead of their group, Julin hung a sudden left. As he disappeared, a dozen men ran to the corner he'd dodged behind and headed the opposite way. They jogged past Dante's rat. In the street, Casey saw them and froze. Still several blocks from the confrontation, Dante stumbled on a loose stone.
It's an ambush.
C stared down the street.
Casey's got them?
I think they might have her.
The minister's people. Should we help her?
He waved his hand for silence and delved into the rat's vision, scrambling for a plan. In the end, it didn't matter. He'd no sooner gotten a look at the groups facing off in the moonlight than the strangers charged. Casey's people ran to meet them. Blades flashed. A man screamed. Speechless, Dante broke into a dead run. The others fell in behind him. It wasn't easy to run through the dark in a strange city and keep his sight inside the rats. And all he caught were glimpses, the 2 lines smashing into each other. A man in a scarf thudding to the pavement. Casey shouting, 2 short blades whirling in her hands. The 2 sides separated, leaving 3 bodies on the ground. The next time Dante looked, they were fighting again. He could hear the clang of steel with his own ears. Casey's voice chopped through the night. Dante slowed enough to cut his arm, then sprinted the rest of the way. As their force hit the street, the minister's men disengaged and ran to the north. Rather than engaging, Casey whirled to face the new threat. Seeing Dante, she strode forward, blades in hand.
"You fed us straight into the lion's mouth."
"We're here to help," Dante said.
"Help walk us into a trap? How would the minister's men know to expect us unless you told them?"
"It could have been one of your men." Her blades twitched. One was dark with blood.
"My men are bricks of an unbroken wall."
"Well, someone had to tip them off."
Dante's jaw dropped.
"The hair."
"The hair? Who the hell is that?"
"A few nights back, Julin had a hair laid across his letters. I thought nothing of it. That it had landed there on its own. When I didn't put it back in place, he knew we were reading his correspondence."
Casey's jaw worked.
"And so he fed us bad intel? Tricked us into walking into a setup?"
"None of my people have any reason to betray you," Dante said. "If it wasn't one of your own, this is the only thing that makes sense."
She lowered her swords, then narrowed her eyes.
"Your fault either way, isn't it?"
C laughed.
"You have no idea how careful we've been. If it was the hair, this would have happened to anyone."
"But it didn't. It happened to you."
Dante bit down on his cheek, hard enough to draw blood. The Nether rushed to meet him. Casey and her men watched him with unwavering stares. He shaped the Nether into a killing point. Behind them, one of the downed men groaned, leg kicking spasmodically. Two of Casey's people ran to help, pulling the scarves from his face. It was Horace.
Let me see to him, Dante said. I'm a healer.
A thief and a healer, Casey said. There anything you can't do? Oh, I got it. Tell the truth.
Dante shrugged. Let him die if you prefer.
A muscle in her jaw twitched. She spat and stood aside. Dante got down beside Horace. His hard leather breastplate had been punctured. Lung, probably. Dante sent the nether inside him and confirmed it. He sent the shadows to work. Horace responded with a gasp, but his eyes stayed shut.
Check their pockets, Casey said.
Her men moved to the two fallen enemy and searched their clothes. Dante moved the nether up Horace's lung in a black line, sealing it together. The man wheezed, then breathed steadily. Dante turned to the 2-inch puncture between his ribs. In a moment, it was gone. He pulled back Horace's shirt and wiped away the blood, revealing smooth skin.
He'll be fine.
Casey had gone still.
What are you? What have you been hiding from me?
Nothing, Dante stood. I've done everything you've asked.
Bullshit. If I'd known you could sling the darkness around, I would have asked for a whole lot more than letters.
She rolled her lips together.
You and me, we're done.
Fine. Good luck with your war.
Casey turned and stalked a couple steps away, breathing hard. Dante began to move back to the others, but someone grabbed his arm.
Wait, Horace said, throat catching. You brought me back.
You weren't gone yet. Dante knelt back down. How do you feel?
Like I've just finished a long run.
The man's eyes darted to Casey. He lowered his voice to a murmur.
She hasn't told you everything. I don't have time to explain. If you want the truth, you'll find it in Moreeve.
Moreeve? This is a city.
Once. Bring the speech of the lost. Anything that can translate the stones.
Translate the... Enough standing around, Casey said, audibly calmer. Let's flap our souls before the watch gets here. Last thing we need is to take the blame for sparking hostilities.
She met Dante's eyes.
You and yours?
I see you again, and I'll bury you in the echoes.
Dante was much too interested in prying tidbits from Horace to bother exchanging threats with her, but her troops were already helping Horace to his feet. They led him away, glancing over their shoulders at Dante.
Do we have any reason to stay here? C said. Then I suggest we take a hint from our former allies and move it.
Dante saw no reason to stick around the streets either. He turned and headed for the inn, thoughts racing.
What just happened? Blue said. What did Horace say to you?
That it's time to leave town.
Have you heard of a place called Moreeve?
No, but I have the feeling I'm about to be tasked with becoming its expert.
Knack, Dante said into the loon. Tell Somba to get out of the echoes and get back to the inn. If he sees Casey, avoid her at all costs.
It sounds like you're about to have Ollivander pacing a rut in the floor,
Knack said.
Just a second.
He was quiet for a bit.
Somber says that won't be a problem. What's going on over there?
For once, it's not worth worrying about. I'll catch you up as soon as I can.
Knack did some grumbling, then shut down his loon. They got to the inn without further problems. Dante sat in the common room, watching the door for Somba. Just as he was ready to get a hold of Knack and ask, Somba slipped inside, eyes roving across the minimal crowd. Upstairs, Dante told him everything that had happened, including Horace's advice to travel to Moreeve.
You trust this, Somba said.
I'd just saved his life, Dante said.
He seemed sincere.
C looked around the low table they were seated around.
Do we have anything left here? Stealing letters is out. Casey wants to pick our teeth with our bones. Dante hasn't turned anything up at the temples. Sounds like there's nothing to lose by going to Mordiv.
Except our lives, Somber said. But even he didn't seem to believe it.
In the morning, they all went to work. Dante headed straight to the Stole of the Winds to ask for the Speech of the Lost. Mikkel had a copy, but there was a snag. He only had one, and transcribing it would take days. He knew a collector, however, and sent Dante with a letter of introduction. The collector wound up parting with the book, but it cost Dante everything he had. He hoped it was a wise purchase.
He got back around sunset. C had put together provisions. Lou and Ast had procured maps and information. Mordiv lay in a desert to the southeast. No one had lived there for as long as anyone could remember. That did zero to dissuade Dante. The others scraped together the last of their coins to pay the stable fees, then plodded out with the mules at dusk. With the city fading behind them, the wind carried the smell of the grass. With the worst of the winter behind them, and their purses as dry and flat as their destination, they camped the nights in the open prairie, burning shrubs for warmth and roasting pigeons and rabbits Dante brought down with the Nether. A small mountain range lay between them and Mordiv, and it looked as if they'd have to detour to a pass. But, accounting for that, he thought they'd reached the ruins within a week. As they traveled, he read through the Speech of the Lost. It was a Wesleyan guide to translating the written language of the Mordivs. His Wesleyan had become quite good, but the book's dialect was older. He and Ast muddled through it. Somber continued to work on cracking the letters. Dante supposed they might yet turn up something useful about Selen, but he suspected Somber felt compelled by the challenge. He was right about the former, and dead wrong about the latter. 3 days out of Ellen, with the grass growing brown and patchy, Somber stopped in his tracks, letter in hand.
"This could be unfortunate," he said.
"What is it?" Dante said. "Did you finally crack the code?"
"Days ago. I've been working through them ever since we left the city."
Somber bit his lip. Uncertain had to proceed. That, in itself, was troubling. Somber trusted no one, but he always believed in himself. He blurted,
"The minister's not planning to attack Ellen. He's going to invade Narashtovik."
Chapter 24
"That's where Televan's been staying," Blaze said. "It has to be the place."
Min shook her head.
"It doesn't feel right."
Denny shifted behind the cover of the shrubs.
"We're going to need a little more than that." "Wait." Blaze tapped his forehead. "It doesn't feel right up here?"
"Exactly," Min said. "But I think he's close."
"Can you tell where?"
She turned away from the home in a slow circle, eyes squeezed shut. When her back was to the house, she pointed across the path toward a dark manor, surrounded by trees and lawns.
"You're sure?" Blaze said.
"That's where the pressure's strongest."
Denny glanced downhill toward the first house.
"But if she's not holding Cal here, why is it patrolled?"
"Heck if I know," Blaze said.
"Maybe they've had problems with her, too.
Whatever the case, blood doesn't lie. Let's move."
A trail branched from the ridge down to the second house. They followed it into a thin field of trees. These stopped 100 yards from the house. Nothing but open grass stood between them and it.
"Well," Blaze said, "ready to do your thing?"
"I'm about to disappear," Min said.
When no one batted an eyelash, she laughed. "I mean, literally, try not to scream."
She gave them a moment to brace themselves, then wrapped herself in shadows and blinked away.
Several of Denny's bodyguards flinched, but to their credit, no one cried out. Blaze tried to find her among the shadows, but could detect no trace. With this phase of operations dependent on her, there was little to do but sit in the trees and wait. The men shifted about, checking their weapons. At times, Blaze thought he heard feet rustling in the grass, but it might have been nothing more than the irregular breeze blowing down from the hills.
"Where did she learn to do that?"
Denny said. "I'm not sure I'm allowed to say," Blaze said.
"Is it a safe place, at least?"
He laughed. "Probably the safest place on Earth."
"That's good to hear. I haven't seen her in years."
"Why did she leave?"
"I'm not sure I'm allowed to say," Denny said.
"Well, given that she doesn't want anything to do with him, I'm guessing it's something her dad did. I don't know whether this is the time for this."
He looked at Blaze, frown deepening.
"How well do you know her?"
"As a student. She's teaching me her disappearing act. Trying to, anyway."
"I can see how that might be a handy thing to learn."
The conversation died off, as it probably should have. They crouched beneath the trees among the smell of dew on grass and the fresh water of the lake. Min was gone for a long time, but neither light nor sound troubled the house. And then she was standing in front of them. This time, two of the men shrieked.
"Quiet," she hissed. "Can anyone here pick a lock?"
"Sure," Blaze said. "I should have guessed. I haven't found Cal, but I think I came close. There's a door in the way."
Blaze had little in the way of tools, but a quick survey of Denny's men turned up an array of needles, pipe cleaners, and beard clips.
"What's the situation in there?" he said.
"It's quiet," Min said. "I saw two watchmen on the ground floor. I think Cal is downstairs."
"You expect me to sneak past them?"
"Use your shadows. And if those fail you, are those swords for decoration?"
He stared at the house. He had to think for a moment before he remembered the last time he'd killed someone. The bandit south of Setevan. 3, 4 months ago. He'd certainly gone longer between deaths, but it was one of the better stretches he'd encountered since beginning his adult life as a hired armsman in Bressel. He'd hoped that, in the seclusion of Pocket Cove, it would have lasted much longer. That he wouldn't always be a tool drawn from the sheath whenever others needed their enemies dispatched to Aron. But perhaps that was what he was. There was no denying he was good at it. Nor could he deny that, when Min had first told him that her cousin was missing, some part of him had known it would come to this.
"We can get to him, no problem," he said. "But he may be hurt, sick. It'll be much tougher to get him out."
"Once you're inside, I'll give you 10 minutes, Denny said. "Then I'll move my people up to the house. If you need us, we'll be right there."
Jinsen nodded. "We don't need to fight them all. We just need to keep them off you long enough to get Cal outside."
Blaze thought this sounded a little thin. He was used to that, but in these situations he was also used to traveling in the partnership of quite possibly the generation's most powerful Nethermancer, and a man who was almost as adept at grabbing disaster by the horns as he was at wielding the shadows. Then again, Blaze had survived 3 years without his potent sidekick, and who wanted to live forever anyway?
"Sounds good," he said. "If they spot us, we can pretend to be drunk lovers who wandered into the wrong house."
"Armed with swords?" Min said.
"We'll say we stole them from someone even drunker."
Min rolled her eyes, then faded until he could only make out hints of her fingernails, hair, and the buttons on her clothes. Just enough for him to follow. They crawled through the grass toward the house. Dew soaked Blaze's doublet and trousers. A lone candle burned upstairs. Min led him around the side of the house to a wooden door in the stone wall. It opened to a dark room, slices of moonlight cutting through the shutters. A sunroom, perhaps. Min grew more opaquely visible, beckoned him down, then faded again. They crawled on hands and knees across a strip of rug down a hallway. This brought them to an expansive room with a snapping fireplace, a dual staircase, a plenitude of chairs, and a silent guard seated on the landing. It smelled like wood smoke and people. The fire threw stark, elongated shadows across the room. His own movements would be much too regular. Blaze had left his Kelevert back at Denny's home, but he reached for the nether anyway, suddenly certain that he could expand it into whipping, spastic expansions exactly like the shadows created by a fire. To his surprise and delight, they did just that. One of Min's buttons gleamed, moving behind the wide stone column containing the fireplace. Blaze followed, disguised by flickering nether. They moved to the darkness of the far side of the column. Min rematerialized and gently opened the door set in its back. Blaze could only see the top step of the staircase leading down, but he could feel the tickle of cold air arising from the depths. Min tugged on his sleeve. She stepped down, and the tread of the step creaked. She stopped and looked up. Blaze heard nothing more but the pop of burning wood. She moved down. He eased the door shut. Its latch clicked, but the sound was muffled by the snap of the fire. They felt their way down, step by step. Once they were at the bottom, Min summoned a faint white light. A banded door barred their path. Blaze got the handful of metal pins from his pocket, careful not to jab himself on the needles. Most locks were dumber than a boiled frog, and this one was no different. He sprung it in seconds. The door opened, presenting them with harsh cold and the smell of feces. Min's expression hardened. Doors stood on both sides of the corridor. Most were unlocked, the rooms beyond filled with bottles, casks, sacks, chests, and old furniture concealed under dusty sheets. Much of the storage seemed devoted to cobwebs and rat turds. They checked room to room until they came to a door that wouldn't budge.
"He's in there," Min whispered.
"How do you know?"
"Because it feels like my brain is about to spray out both ears like flame from a dragon's nostrils."
He set to work on the door. Its lock was stickier than the first, and he had to scrabble around at it for so long that he began to doubt anyone was behind it, certain the noise would have woken them. At last, the lock clicked, and he saw why there had been no response from within. The man huddled in a blanket, his pale shins projecting from its end. He smelled as bad as he looked. Sores glared from his face. His left hand clutched the end of the blanket. It was heavily bandaged and crusted with old blood.
"Cal!"
Min rushed to him, sweeping him up in her arms. He jarred awake and scrabbled back, his eyes locked on hers. Fear melted to confusion, then disbelief.
"Min?" "Don't move. You'll feel better in a moment."
She got out a knife and nicked the back of her wrist. Shadows swarmed from her to him. His eyelids fluttered. The sores on his face skinned over. The hitch in his breathing soothed. He shook his bandaged hand, then scratched at it. When Min fell back, he still looked like a man who'd spent too long at sea, but he was able to stand, keeping his blanket around his bare skin.
"How did you do that?"
He glanced at Blaze.
"And who is he?"
"A man of many talents." Min grinned so wide it was a wonder her teeth didn't fall out.
"Your dad's outside. Take my cloak. Can you walk?"
Something scraped upstairs. It was faint, yet Blaze pegged it at once, the unmistakable sound of someone moving less quietly than they believed. Something twitched from the corner of the room. There, a rat stood on its hind legs. One of its eyes was missing. The other was glassy but fixed firmly on him.
We've been seen, he breathed.
By who? Min said. Ourselves?
Talavand is a Nethermancer.
He drew out one of his swords, and we're in deep shit.
He closed on the rat. Before it had a chance to react, he hacked it in half, then cut its head in two for good measure.
Come on.
They followed him into the hall. Two doors down, he ducked into one of the storage rooms and made to get behind a barrel.
What are you doing? Min said. We can't hide. If she knows the Nether, I'm the only one who can stand against her.
She was right. This pissed him off beyond measure. At the risk of sounding like a coward, do you think you can sneak up on her?
Could be. I doubt she'll be expecting one of her own.
He moved back to the corridor, wishing they'd left the doors open. Shadow walk up to the door and open it as softly as you can. If anyone comes down, I'll deal with them. If not, have a look round and let us know if it's clear. Sound good?
Good enough, she said.
She hugged Cal again.
If anything happens to me, follow Blaze. He'll get you out of here.
Cal nodded, fighting down his confusion. Min smiled wanly and vanished. Cal gasped and staggered back into Blaze.
She's pretty talented, right?
Blaze whispered. He moved back into the darkness of the storage room. Min's feet whispered up the steps. The door creaked. Blaze's heart thundered. After 15 beats, boots rasped on the steps. The tip of a sword moved past the doorway. As soon as he saw the man's elbow, Blaze burst forward, driving his sword into where he gauged the neck would be. His aim was true. The man dropped gargling blood to the bare stone floor. Blaze followed him down and severed his spine. The man went silent. Blaze waited, gazing up the black stairwell. The darkness was so complete he saw sparks swimming in his eyes. The silence was so total he heard the hum of his blood in his ears. Upstairs, the door inched open. He held his position. 30 seconds later, he felt warmth on his cheek. Min swam into place beside him.
Looks clear, she whispered. We can't stay down here all night.
Blaze drew his second sword.
I'll lead with Cal. Please, for the sake of me not dying in a stranger's basement, if you see any sign of shadows, strike her dead.
She nodded. He turned to Cal. Cal gripped his shoulder. They began their ascent. The treads sided with him, maintaining their silence. Up top, the diffused glow of the fire granted barely enough light to make out the floor. After a look around, he stepped out, Cal holding onto him for strength. Blaze reached into the Nether, trying to sense its presence in other bodies, but felt nothing. He waited for a full minute, but heard nothing but the crackle of the fire. He brought Cal to the wall and moved in the direction of the sunroom. A quarter of the way around the broad column housing the fireplace, he stopped for a quick look around. Shadows wavered, but the room was as empty as before. Something sizzled through the air. Blaze jerked Cal down. A cold force struck his back. He shouted involuntarily. Pain shot through him, but rather than plowing through him, the bolt of shadows exploded in a bloom of heatless sparks. Min shimmered into view, arm outstretched toward the landing, Nether dripping from her hands. Bodyguards charged into the room, bearing swords and spears, blocking the way to the sunroom. Blaze didn't fear them. He feared the woman silhouetted on the landing, the woman whose hands were balls of darkness. Glass shattered from the front of the house. Blaze shoved Cal back toward the door to the basement. Get downstairs! Talavan's bodyguards tore across the room. They'd be on him in a moment. Without waiting to see if Cal was following orders, Blaze sprinted to the left wing of the double staircase to the upper floors, vaulting the rail. Wood splintered behind him, pinging his cloak. He hit the stairs running. Below, three men chased him, while the other five turned and ran toward the sound of the broken glass. Jinsen's voice rang out. Blaze reached the second floor landing. Talavant backpedaled, banging into a wall. Nether streaked from her fingers. From downstairs, Min deflected the first bolt. The second hit Blaze's feet. He cringed, expecting them to be sheared off at the ankle. Instead, they rooted to the ground. He crashed on his face. He fought to stand, but his feet wouldn't move. The guards pounded up the steps. Taliband and Min faced each other, grappling with half-seen forces. Blaze's feet were stuck fast, but he was able to twist around to a sitting position. He had held onto both swords during the fall. The first of the guards was upon him. Smirking, the man reached out as far as he could, driving his sword at Blaze's chest. Blaze flung himself to the side and twisted out of the way of the incoming blade. Fresh pain tore through his wounded shoulder. He dropped his left-hand sword and snapped at the man's wrist. This was out of reach, so he snagged the man's crossguard instead and leaned back with all his weight. If the bodyguard had had a moment to think, he would have simply let go, but the instinct to pull back won out. Already leaning toward him, off balance, the man was unable to resist. He fell forward, plunging straight into Blaze's right-hand sword. The man was beginning to shriek as a spear darted at Blaze. Blaze flattened himself, leveraging the impaled guard up. The spear gored the man in the back. Blaze rocked forward and pushed him off his sword, tumbling him down the stairs into the legs of the spearman. They fell in a tangle, lodging against the wall. The third guard grabbed the dropped spear and raised it high, its iron point shining in the firelight. Across the room, both women screamed. Blaze's feet yanked free of their unnatural roots. He kicked back from the soldiers, grabbing for his fallen second sword. The spear clunked into the landing and withdrew. Blaze followed it in. The man wheeled his spear, but its butt whacked against the wall. Blaze smacked it aside with one sword and drove his second into the man's heart. While he was there, he took care of the tripped man, who was still fighting to free himself from his friend's dead weight. The stairs were now clear. Men were hollering across the ground floor, maneuvering around tables, throwing knives and vases at each other. On the landing, Taliband crumpled to one knee, holding her bleeding hip. Below, Min lay prone, crawling toward the pocket of safety beneath the landing. Blaze ran toward Taliband and put the edge of his sword to her throat. "Bad news. I know the Nether too. Not well, mind you, but if I see you make the slightest move toward it, you will see how good I am with a sword." Her eyes danced between his. She was in her mid-50s, black hair hanging in two braids. She was dressed in a dark nightgown, and she looked very afraid.
"Who are you?"
"Mean," Blaze said. "Call off your men. No one else needs to die." She licked her lips, then turned her head to look downstairs, wincing as the motion pressed the sword against her skin.
"Stand down," she called.
Swords clanged below.
She snarled, "I said stand down!"
The sword play ceased. A man backed toward the stairs, glancing over his shoulder. "Ma'am?"
"Put down your weapons before this man puts his through my throat."
More guards backed into the firelight. They glanced between each other, then set down their swords. Denny and Jinsen advanced, accompanied by their troops.
"Are you all right?"
Denny shouted.
"Help Min," Blaze said. "Cal's in the basement. He's beat up, but he's fine."
Denny and the two guards jogged beneath the landing. Jinsen and the others escorted Taliban soldiers away. "This was about the almanac, wasn't it?" Blaze said. Taliban nodded carefully.
"I'm just an agent. This wasn't my idea."
"Then what? You stumbled into Cal's Stotts in the street and he wound up in your pocket?"
"I won't deny what I've done, but the people holding my reins are worth much more than my life."
Blaze laughed humorlessly. "I'm not so sure about that."
"Is that so?"
A hint of mockery entered her eyes.
"Do you place so little value on the head of your king?"
His heart did painful things in his chest.
"The king?
Modigan sent you."
"Do I have your interest now?"
"Indeed.
Now we're going to sit here until people with the authority to make decisions arrive. This took a while, but Blaze didn't mind the breather. After what felt like an hour, but was probably 10 minutes, the others reconvened downstairs. Min and Cal could move around, but weren't in great shape. They'd found Cal some clothes, at least. So Blaze walked Tullivant downstairs, still holding his sword to her neck. "Care to have your brains melted?" he asked them. "She's working for the king." Denny put himself nose to nose with her.
"Why were you mutilating my son over a book?"
"The finger was as far as we intended to go," Tullivant said. "You'll note we made sure to clip it from his offhand."
"Why, you're a model of mercy."
"Given what my lord was willing to do to attain the book, I was saintly."
"Answer the question," Blaze said.
Tullivant's face contorted in thought. She gave a short sigh through her nose.
"He wanted the book because he thought it would lead him to Selen."
This last bit was gibberish to Blaze. Denny appeared equally nonplussed. Cal looked like he wanted a meal and a bath. But Min had the expression of someone who's been struck in the stomach with a spear.
"He thinks it's back," she said.
"There are signs," Tullivant said. "Strong signs."
"Strong enough to kill for?"
Min grimaced.
"Then again, any sign of Selen would tempt him."
Tullivant nodded, then smiled oddly.
"You fight well, lady. Who trained you?"
Min smiled back.
"No one you'd know."
"Right," Blaze said. "What is happening right now?"
"Let's be clear. We're bargaining for your life," Min said to Tullivant, entirely ignoring Blaze. "What else can you toss on the table?"
She laughed.
"What could be better than Selen?"
"How is he so sure? And how does he intend to find it?"
"The lights in the Wodens, the creatures we've been finding in the Ripping Sea, other things I'm not privy to. As to how he means to get it, I can't say. It was my job to bring him the almanac at all costs. If I return with nothing, I'll be killed on the spot."
"It would be finely deserved," Denny said.
"I think I believe her," Blaze said.
"Surely you don't think we should let her go?"
"I've interrogated a lot of assholes over the years. True believers never give up what you want to hear.
She doesn't give two shits about Modigan. She just wants to survive." Min laughed.
"You think that makes her more trustworthy?"
"I wouldn't take her out for drinks," Blaze said. "But I know Modigan well enough to believe she can never cross his sight again."
"She hurt Cal," Denny said. "Took his finger."
"It's your call. And good luck with it. While you're doing that, would someone care to do me the favor of explaining what the hell Selen is?"
Min and Tullivant exchanged looks. Tullivant spoke first.
"We believe it is a source of pure nether, one that, in able hands, can be put to almost any use."
"What's your take?" he asked Min.
"That's what I've been taught."
She frowned at Tullivant.
"But it's been more than a millennium since it last manifested."
Tullivant could only shrug.
Denny paced around her. "If you left here tonight, where would you go?"
"Malin," she said without hesitation. "I might try Narashtovic. They have no love for Modigan and are hungry for talent. But I'd fear that's not nearly far enough for me to run."
Denny turned to his son. "I'd give you the choice, but that would shift the responsibility to your shoulders. How do you feel?"
"I don't care," Cal said. "I just want to go home."
"Leave now," Denny declared to Tullivant. "Go alone, and never let me see you in Galador or Garsk again."
She eyed him, expecting some trick, then bowed her head.
You won't regret it.
I do already. She showed no sign of offense. She limped over to a rack